title of the talk tonight is The Risk of Mindfulness. Rodney has been eagerly waiting to see what this title means. However, he's going to have to wait a little more. I have a bit of a wind-up. I need to set the stage. So I'm going to begin with a quote from the Buddha from one of his most wonderful talks called the Satipatthana Sutra. And the quote is this: "There is a way, O practitioners, to help living beings realize purification, overcome grief and sorrow, end pain and anxiety, travel the wise path, and realize liberation. This way is the four foundations of mindfulness." As I said, this comes from a discourse or talk of the Buddha's called the Satipatthana Sutra, which some of you may already know, and others of you may want to look into at some point, because it's one of those discourses that you might want to have with you if you were on a desert island and you couldn't have anything else. It's quite a great discourse. And it has to do with being aware of this body-mind process. It speaks to the awareness of this process of body and mind. And the word satipatthana, sati means mindfulness, connection, contact, recollection, and patthana means to establish or foundations. So what it translates into is the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four ways of being present. And these four ways of being present include the whole world, the whole inner world. Nothing is left out. The four ways are being aware, mindful of the body, which is what we've been practicing with, being mindful and aware of what is called vedana, or sensation, which means being aware of the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral texture of our experience in the body and in the mind. So it's very interesting. The third foundation of mindfulness is that of emotions, mental states, thoughts. And the fourth foundation of mindfulness, way of being present, are the laws of experience. So kind of how everything fits together and the lawfulness of our experiences. The Buddha said, in contemplating these four ways of being present, the heart detaches from its torments and is liberated. In contemplating these four ways of being present, the heart detaches from its torments and is liberated. So in being mindful and aware in all ways possible of everything that occurs in this body-mind experience, we get to see the difference between the heart and that which has a chokehold over it, that which is tormenting us. It is only by being in contact, only through mindfulness, that we can understand ourselves and our lives. Only what mindfulness contemplates can wisdom understand. The Buddha said this too. Only what mindfulness contemplates can wisdom understand. In other words, if there is an actual contact, intimacy, connection with our experiences in the body and in the mind, we will learn anyway, but it will be an intellectual knowledge. It won't be the kind of learning that has to seep into our bones. that truly brings about the kind of understanding that brings us into liberation. So, all of this makes sense, sounds good. Just, you know, I just gave three quotes of the Buddha. They all probably sound pretty good. I'm biased, but you may be too. So why are we so resistant to being mindful when really actually these are the fruits? The heart detaching itself from its torments. Our sensing or being able to know realization, liberation. Why are we so resistant to being mindful? Mindfulness is a choice. So why do we so oftentimes choose disconnection? We choose disconnection because mindfulness is perceived as a risk. A large aspect of our practice is learning to trust mindfulness over thinking. To be mindful is to be present, and we fear being present. We fear that things will be unbearable, our life will be unbearable if we are present, if we are fully present. We may have the belief that before allowing, permitting ourselves to be present, we have to fix ourselves first. We have to be perfect first before we can allow ourselves to let go. See if you can notice whether there is that belief occurring in you. We may fear finding a hollowness within if we're present in all the moments that we have the option of being present in. We may be afraid of what we'll find. We may be afraid that we'll find that there is a void within, that there is an emptiness within, not the positive kind of emptiness, empty of greed, hatred, and delusion, but what could be called a small e emptiness, you know, nothingness. And we may indeed fear that we'll find ourselves in endless despair. We'll discover a permanency of despair within if we are awake in all moments. In being present, we do meet ourselves, and we don't always like what we see. One teacher said that in practicing, it's as if it's just one insult after another. Over and over again, being insulted, you know, by ourselves, one must say, which is even worse. But, you know, having to put up with being insulted. Gandhi put it like this: I have only three enemies. My favorite enemy, the one most easily influenced for the better, is the British Empire. My second enemy, the Indian people, is far more difficult. But my most formidable opponent is a man named Mohandas K. Gandhi. With him, I seem to have very little influence. Which I'm sure we have empathy for. We can resonate with ourselves. It is a risk. It really is a risk to let go of the past. We throw it out so kind of easily. Let go of the past. Let go of the past moment. But we do experience it as a risk at times. We may believe, we may have the belief system that we have to work out the past, that there's some way in which we have to work things out. We can't be present until we understand the past. Now, from the perspective of the Buddha, and, you know, one doesn't at all have to believe this, but from this perspective, perhaps there have been many, many lifetimes. And so if you think about that, that not only with this belief system do we have to work out the enormous complications that we all experience from this lifetime, not only this one, but lifetimes before this one, endless complications, you know, endless arguments with people, endless difficulties, you know, endless complications. So it's really daunting when we think about it like that. Take the easier route. The past has formed our identity. You know, oftentimes we relate to ourselves through who we have been. You know, who we have been, what we have done, how people have perceived us. You know, a lot on the have, not so much on now. You know? And there's a certain identity that is formed because of the way that we hold on to the past and relate to what has occurred in the past. And so it can feel like a risk to be mindful, to be present, because we think, who am I? You know, maybe I'm not someone who I want to be. Maybe I don't like my past and I would like to not see myself in this way, but at least it's better than this question of who am I without it, you know, because that perhaps is a greater fear. It is a perceived risk as well to let go of our habits. What is there when our habits are not? What is there when judging is not happening, when worrying is not happening? Worrying takes up a lot of time, takes up a lot of space in our minds. You know? What is there when fantasizing isn't there? Will we have a life of endless boredom? You know? It's doubtful, but who knows? One has to find this out for oneself. What happens when rehearsing is not there? When we let go of practicing for something to come? You know? Which, of course, sometimes can be helpful, but when we do it a million times over and over again, and then we go into the situation, and of course the other person doesn't cooperate with the lines we have given them. At some point, we realize that the rehearsing is a habit. Yeah? And then, you know, the risk of not rehearsing, that's where it can feel like a risk. And, of course, it is a risk. It is perceived by us as a risk to let go of the known. You know, we are always entering the unknown when we are practicing. We never know what's going to happen. And so to let go of the known is oftentimes experienced with fear. What will happen? Over and over again, the practice invites us to leap, encourages us to leap out of the known into the unknown. And as we do, as we take this leap, and we take this leap not just once, but over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. In taking this leap, we gradually discover a trust in being present. When we risk letting go of our habits, when we take that risk, when we're daring, when we allow ourselves to risk, when we choose mindfulness instead of choosing to perpetuate our habits, It can feel like we're breaking up with old friends. You know? Old friends who may not serve us the way they had, but certainly are familiar. Old friends who are comforting in their familiarity and are limiting as well. Sometimes we actually experience this not only in terms of our habits. Sometimes when we first come to the practice, it's why we need a community of like-minded others, is because sometimes we find that there's not the same sense of simpatico with those that we have been with all along. You know, and it's not as if we want to abandon anyone or anything along these lines. And at the same time, we need something new. We need support. We need the sense of not being alone in this path, on this path, which includes not just the sense of lineage, of knowing that many, many people have been on this path for over 2,500 years and obviously have not wasted their time. It's also in the realm of friendship, of sangha. It's encouraging ourselves to find a place within our circle of friendship. Really understanding the importance of like-minded others, of beings where there is a certain degree of simpatico. In no way are we separating ourselves. But we are looking in a fresh way. So we are allowing ourselves not to be limited, to risk and to dare. It is not easy to be present when pain is our experience, either physical or mental pain. It's not easy at all. This is when we really want to fantasize. This is when we want to just try to do anything until the bell rings. Thinking that the bell will ring sooner if we cook up a good fantasy and we won't have to experience the pain. This is something by one of my favorite teachers named Tofu Roshi. You heard it right. Was also known as Susan Moon. An aspect of meditation practice that is difficult for Americans, and particularly Californians, to accept is the pain in the knees that so often accompanies meditation, and the idea that one should not move, not try to get away from it, but simply accept it. In California, you are supposed to do what feels good. In some parts of the United States, like New York and Boston, suffering comes more easily to the inhabitants. It's true. But even there, the tradition tends to be one of mental rather than physical anguish. Tofu Roshi worked patiently to teach us that even in America, even in California, life is suffering, whether you know it or not. You're suffering when you have pain in your knees, and you're suffering when you think you're having fun. He made up a chant for us. I accept the pain that visits my knees like hummingbird to honeysuckle. We suffer no matter what state we are in, including California. Sitting is suffering. Surfing is suffering. With all beings, we accept our pain. Halfway through a long meditation retreat, when my knees were feeling exactly like honeysuckle flowers being pierced by the sharp bill of a hummingbird, it was very comforting to chant this chant together with my fellow sufferers. There's nothing against California. The acceptance is really the key with pain. It's really to go against the instinct that we have. The instinct that is within us is to try to push it away, is to try to resist it. And so to very gently and very kindly and with a huge degree of affection, to see if we can go against that instinct and actually very carefully, particularly when we feel strong. When we don't, then we need to back off. But when we feel steady and when we feel strong, to actually begin to try to welcome it in. You know, it sounds so counterintuitive. It sounds ridiculous, actually. It sounds like something that doesn't make sense at all. But actually, once we've had a taste of this, it makes all the sense in the world. And we begin to be able to trust it. You know, when we've had this experience of experiencing pain, either physical or emotional, and we remember not to push it away, because we also remember, and I think this remembering has to be said a million trillion times, that when we resist, we are actually strengthening what we want to get rid of. It's one of those spiritual laws that, as I said, I think we have to hear over and over again, because the instinct is so strong. We're learning something totally new than what we have known. But when we've had that experience of pain, either physical or emotional, and we remember not to push away, not to resist, but actually to soften into it, and even, and this is the wild part, even to welcome it a little bit, not in a masochistic way, not to torture ourselves, but because by welcoming it, we can bring the light of awareness to it, and it can begin to change, because we can begin to see that it is changing. We can begin to see its impermanent nature when we're willing to bring it a little bit closer to us instead of holding it at arm's length or much further than arm's length. You know? So when we have this kind of experience, and even to take on something small like an itch, you know, rather than the biggest emotional pain that one is experiencing, but something small and workable and manageable like an itch, and noticing the instinct to push it away, to resist it, and instead seeing if we can actually do the opposite, soften into it, welcome it, embrace it, open our arms to it, while paying very, very close and kind and caring attention. And then noticing what happens. It's surprising. It's unexpected. It's not what we expect to have happen, because we have learned the path of resistance, and somehow we still believe in it, even though it doesn't work. So we're letting go of our belief in resistance as being a route to freedom. And instead, we are placing our trust in welcoming, embracing, getting closer to softening. We do learn a lot about resistance, and we need to learn about resistance instead of judging resistance when it arises, and instead of resisting resistance. You know, when we're sophisticated yogis, we tend to resist the resistance because we don't think we're supposed to be experiencing resistance. It was the same thing with judgment. We think we're not supposed to be judging, so we tend to judge the judging. And so instead of resisting the resistance and instead of judging the resistance, we can understand that it's in the very nature of practice to resist. We find ourselves in wonderful company in resistance. We find ourselves part of this ancient lineage when we notice resistance. It actually means that we're practicing. Now, we don't experience resistance when we're not earnest and sincere. But when we're willing to stay quiet, stay still, be with things a little bit more as they are, we are bound to experience resistance because we are up against an edge. And then we need to gently nudge that edge rather than judging the resistance. We don't want to take it as anything personal. but instead to see it as natural. Nisargadatta, who was a wonderful teacher in India, said, "We resist each step until enlightenment. Each step along the way, we resist until we're totally and utterly free." So it's not going to go away anytime soon, is the point there. However, we do need to trust something deeper than our conditioning to continue in practice. And we don't want to bow down to the resistance. We don't want to honor it. We don't want to cooperate with it. Because when we do, we are not working with that edge. And working with that edge in practice, is the most important thing we can do. And when we are at that edge, there is bound to be the signal that we are at that edge, because there will be resistance occurring. And then if we can work with the resistance, in other words, welcome the resistance, soften into the resistance, not just try to get to what we're resisting, but see the resistance itself as valuable, as important, as significant. That's our way in. That's actually our path in. When we encounter the hindrances, the obstacles, the difficulties in practice, when we encounter irritation and aversion, when we encounter longing and restlessness, when we encounter inertia and doubt, even if we have tended to trust mindfulness to some extent, generally, when we encounter the difficulties, the hindrances, our tendency is not to trust mindfulness. And this is why we can have a very committed and lively daily practice, where there can be a lot of faith operating. And then we come on a retreat and we experience tons of doubt. The reason is because on a retreat, we are actually welcoming, inviting the hindrances to visit. We're kind of like sitting ducks, We're sitting there and saying, bring it on, in a sense. And so, of course, we're going to see all of these things within ourselves. There is no way to not. However, we do want to question our tendency to not trust mindfulness when we are experiencing a hindrance, a difficulty. Our instinct is to try to absorb into the obstacle, the hindrance. By the way, the word for hindrance in Pali is nivarana. And nivarana means that which hinders. And so the full statement is that which hinders by covering up the natural radiance of the heart. I hope every time you hear the word hindrance from now on, you will actually end with that paragraph. That which hinders by covering up the natural luminescence of the heart. However, what we tend to do is to try to absorb into whatever the hindrance is, instead of observing it with affection. Our tendency is to try to fix it and to try to get rid of it, to do anything other than be mindful of it. In our practice, we learn to gently hold whatever obstacles, difficulties, hindrances come about with spaciousness and with acceptance. Instead of relating to the inner torments with inner torment, which is oftentimes what we do, we add to the experience of torment. And we relate to conditioning through our conditioning. Whereas mindfulness is calling forth that which is new, that which is fresh, that which is deeply alive. And so very, very different to touch what is happening with mindfulness instead of digging a deeper hole for ourselves by relating to our conditioning with our conditioning. As I said, relating to our inner torments with inner torment. Letting whatever arises, arise. As you may have noticed, we don't have much say-so over it anyway. Yeah? What arises is out of our control. So, taking the graceful route, you know, the route of surrender, which means allowing whatever arises to arise, and as well, contemplating its disappearance. Oftentimes, we see the arising. We don't notice the disappearance because we're not around for it. You know, we've spaced out before we see change, before we see any kind of disappearance. So we want to allow whatever arises to arise and to contemplate its disappearance as well. The present moment is an acquired taste. It really is an acquired taste. We are conditioned, deeply conditioned actually, to find being present, at least at times, maybe not all the time, but at least at times we're conditioned to find being present confining and boring and not stimulating enough, not enough to keep us interested. There can be kind of a false sense of expansion when we're roaming around in the past and the future. You know, we're sitting here just looking like we're practicing, and we can be in France. You know, the mind can travel so far away. It's wonderful, too. You know, it's quite amazing what our minds can do and how far they can travel. We just get so enraptured with this, and we think of it as expansiveness. You know, we get so delighted with this fact, and we think of it as expansiveness. The problem is we always have to come back. You know, we can't stay there. We can't stay wherever we have roamed to. We always have to come back, and we always have to come back to ourselves. Slowly, in our practice, we are developing a love for the present moment. Nothing other than that. Now, nothing tepid about it. Nothing lukewarm. We are actually developing a love for the present moment. And in the development, in the seeing of the present in a radically different way, we find ourselves less enchanted with that which isn't now. So we find ourselves less enchanted as we develop this love for the present moment. It's in tandem. It happens correspondingly. Gradually, there comes about a hard won, and we know it's quite hard won, and it's good, you know, it's good effort, it's good work, a hard won taste for reality. We are learning to love and to trust being here. Because of past pain in our lives, the present can be perceived as an enemy. And so part of our practice is learning that it is safe to be present. And we actually find with a deeper level of interest and investigation that it is actually the only safe place to be. We are off balance when we are lost in our thoughts. We don't have our wits about us. We are actually gone. We are unprepared. We are unable to respond to what is asked of us in this life. We are unable to be sensitive to our own suffering and to the suffering of others because we're not around. You know, it's very unsafe, actually. And so we learn gradually, and quite gradually, that it is the safe place to be here, to be responsive instead of reactive. The practice is training our heart to trust in our own experiences. Our tendency is to trust the mind of thoughts and of fears, to trust the mind of judgments and viewpoints and opinions. What we are learning in our practice is to trust the heart. Trusting the heart is to trust the senses. In smelling, there is just smelling. In tasting, there is just tasting. I should first say that somebody completely woke up when the Buddha said this to him. So listen really carefully. In smelling, there is just the smelling. In tasting, there is just the tasting. In touching, there is just the touching. In thinking, there is just the thinking. In feeling, there is just the feeling. This is it. This is enough. So orienting ourselves instead towards listening and a perspective, a way of listening, of sensing, of receiving, and of responding. Over and over again, relaxing into the here and now. I have an adorable niece who is now 13. When she was really small, we used to call her on the phone, and she lived down in Florida, and the rest of the family was up in the East. And we used to call her on the phone, and of course, what you say to somebody is, what are you up to? What are you doing? So I would call her, and I would say, okay, cutie, what are you doing right now? And how she would always respond, is she would say, I'm talking to you. You know, and the subtext was, you idiot. You know, what else would I be doing? Yeah. She was so in the now. Of course, that was her whole world. Yeah. So relaxing more and more into the here and now. We don't want to try too hard to be mindful. We don't want to try to be mindful in any kind of idealized way. You know, because when we are trying to fit into a concept, we miss the mark and we actually overshoot. You know, because we're attempting to fit into a concept. It's like hearing the word calm or joy and then always looking for that experience. You know, based on somebody else's experience instead of from within oneself. You know, and this is always the way, is from within oneself. Instead, what we want to do is to simply try to keep up with life, keep up with ourselves, instead of lagging behind and instead of hurrying ahead. From moment to moment, keeping up with ourselves. Mindfulness is freshness. It's an absence of the habitual. Mindfulness of the habitual is absolutely fine. It's mindfulness. But when we're mindful of the habitual is not the habitual. It doesn't have the same grip over us. And it gives us space for inner seeing, for seeing something in a new way, in an unexpected way, in sometimes a surprising way. In taking the risk of being mindful, we find out that it's not really a risk at all. It was a trick title. It offers what our hearts yearn for. The risk of being mindful is that of discovering freedom. It's that of living a full life, which involves an intimacy with all things. False ideas about who we are drop away, and we are left with a luminous knowing. May all beings take the risk of being mindful. May all beings understand life within themselves May all beings live with great affection and respect for all things. Why don't we sit for just a moment?